One of the things that makes the recent hate crimes in the United States so shocking and outrageous is that they seem to go against the grain of American life. They're out of character and un-American. But if I can paraphrase what one of my fellow historians said recently, the citizen in me hates what is happening in America now. The historian in me knows that this has always happened in America. In the wake of everything that happened last week, several of you have asked me to do a show about the history of hate crimes in the United States. It'll take a while for me to produce a show on the full history of hate crimes, but since it's a topic on many minds right now, I'll say a few general things about that history, and then we'd like to play for you again the show we previously did on the KKK. It addresses many of the underlying issues of hate and bigotry that seem to be continually with us in the United States. In recent decades, hate crime, as a phrase, has been defined as a crime motivated by bias or prejudice, at least partly because the victim belongs to a race or social group, and that the perpetrator of that crime seeks to go beyond a simple crime, if you will, and to express hatred towards the group that the victim represents. Although hate crime wasn't used as a description in 19th century America, the Civil Rights Act of 1871 addressed exactly the same idea. The Ku Klux Klan and others had committed, essentially, hate crimes against African Americans during the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War. And the 1871 Act was needed to add extra gravity to racially motivated crimes, especially murder. In the 20th century, the 1968 Civil Rights Act broadened the meaning of hate crime to include religion and national origin. And subsequent federal laws from the 1970s to the 2010s have widened the circle of potentially affected groups as American society has become more aware of the need for such laws. Since hate crime has had this specific legal meaning in recent decades, historians have been naturally, wary of applying that phrase to the worst expressions of hate and bigotry in American history, the phrase hate crimes. It's a phrase that could be seen as technically anachronistic since it wasn't commonly used until the late 20th century, or the second half of the 20th century, I should say. Well, apart from the concerns of historians of language, this is unnecessarily finicky in ordinary conversation. Lynching and other outrages were clearly hate crimes. And of course, any reasonable person would consider that the nearly systematic removal, and worse, of Native Americans from their homelands was a hate crime. At times like this, when there are killings motivated by race hatred and religious bigotry, we're often prompted to look back on the good old days when these things didn't happen. Unfortunately, tragically, horribly, there was no time when these things didn't happen. Yes, the increased ownership of assault weapons seems to have made murderous hate crimes all too easy these days, and there's no excuse for letting that happen in a modern society. But there was no excuse for letting lynching happen. There was no excuse for letting the murder of Emmett Till happen. And since we all ought to know about these things and be stunned by their constancy in American history, there's no excuse for failing to fight much harder than we ever have to try to eliminate them. It would be a wonderful thing indeed if, one day not far off, the innate historian in all of us could factually say, these things used to happen in the United States, but not anymore. We've become genuinely stronger than hate crimes. And so, here's our previous episode about the KKK, and I'll talk more with you next week.
Ladies. Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, that's right. It's me, Professor Buzzkill, busting myths, taking names, and ruining your day since 1963. You know, very few people actually care why I started this show, but I did so because I worried about the strength with which cultures seem to hold on to historical myths. That strength seemed to me to be one of the things that affected our thinking and sometimes the way we acted and perhaps even the way we do very important things like choosing the people we associate with and how we vote. Anyway, that's one of the things I stressed in our initial crowdfunding video. And I thought that being a history show, there wouldn't be as much pressure to crank out topical material like I would have to on a current affairs show or a political show. But that was a very stupid thing to think, Buzzkillers. I knew better. History happens every day, and at various times, reminders of tense and tragic episodes from the past hit us at a very rapid rate. That's going on now. Recently, events in Charlottesville, Virginia, and other places have prompted many of you to ask me about the history of vile and extremist organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan and the myths surrounding those organizations. So that's what this show is going to be about, the KKK. It's a distressing topic in nearly every way and in nearly every detail. The KKK and similar groups and ideologies have plagued this country ever since the end of the Civil War. This has meant 150 years of hate and violence, and brainwashing, and the misuse and misunderstanding of history. Other ideologies have been wrapped up with the KKK at various stages in its history, and it's an unsurprising but unsettling fact that we've also been plagued with versions of nativism, white supremacy, white nationalism, anti-Catholicism, anti-Semitism, anti-immigration, neo-fascism, neo-Nazism, and these neo-Confederates for at least a century and a half. Practically every topic I discuss in this episode really deserves its own full episode, but given what's going on in many places in the United States right now, I thought I'd have a specific episode on the KKK. Now, there are a lot of complexities of the Klan's history. In the first place, number one, there were three periods of Klan activity, 1865 to 71, 1915 to 1944, and 1946 to the present. Each of these three clans were somewhat different and were founded in reaction to developments in American society and culture that were going on at the time and that were perceived, and I want to stress perceived, because that happens a lot in the Klan's history, as threats. Secondly, the Klan's organization is kind of a myth, or there are lots of myths about it. For instance, Nathan Bedford Forrest's famous leadership of the first Klan was not very complete and wasn't as successful as is often portrayed in the media and films and things like that. And finally, the Klan, particularly in the 1920s and 30s, was a lot more urban than rural. And Klan chapters were found in nearly every state, not just in the South. We often seek one cause or one answer for how and why something happened. But historical causes that brought the Klan about are as complex as anything in history. Two things, though, I want to talk about the Klan are not complex. They are its root philosophy, hate, and its expression of that hatred, violence and murder. It's probably best to take this all chronologically, Buzzkillers, and I'll explain the history and the myths of the KKK as we go along. So let's go back to Pulaski, Tennessee in 1865. That's when the Ku Klux Klan was founded, on Christmas Eve of that year, roughly 7.5 months after the Civil War ended. Six Confederate veterans got together and formed the KKK as a fraternal organization. The name Ku Klux Klan seems to come from combining the ancient Greek word kuklos, meaning circle, with the English word clan. A kuklos had been used for other fraternal organizations, so it's not just the KKK. It's not clear what the initial activities of this infant clan were, but it grew very quickly. along with many other secret organizations in the South. These groups were made up primarily of ex-Confederate soldiers and men unhappy with the early attempts at reconstructing the South after the war. Now let's remember what happened after the war, Buzzkillers. Generally speaking, the Republican government in the North in Washington, D.C., tried to remove slavery and many aspects of legal inequality from the former states of the Confederacy. Of course, first of all, slavery was abolished. Freedmen, that's freed African-American men who had been slaves, were granted many civil rights, and some of them worked their way up to becoming members of state legislatures as well as being in local government. White men had to swear an oath that they had never supported the secession and they never supported the Confederacy before they could get their voting rights back. And other political and legal reforms were pushed through from 1866 until mid-1877 when Reconstruction ended. In many ways, the results of Reconstruction were a mess. Some improvements were made, but a great deal of reforms in the South were abandoned, and lots of important civil rights achievements were negated by subsequent Southern state governments in the following decades, the late 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and on. There was a lot of chaos, as you can imagine, as well as much tension. The KKK and many other offensive organizations stepped into this scenario. Think about it. Confederate veterans were all around, all with military experience, as well as many white men who believed that their way of life had been taken away by outside groups, including Republican politicians at all levels, scallywags who were white Southerners who had collaborated with Northern Republicans, recently enfranchised black men, carpetbaggers, and on and on. Klan groups spread pretty rapidly in the second half of the 1860s, and most states suffered from Klan violence until the end of 1871. So what did these Klans do? Well, although they were careful to disguise themselves with various hoods and masks, KKK members across the South made sure to terrorize their opponents, overwhelmingly black people, by killing them ritualistically, often leaving their bodies in places where they could be easily found. This is very, very public, in other words. They burned houses, they stole and killed livestock, they destroyed other property, and made no bones about advertising that they, the KKK, had done it. And they certainly made no bones about threatening their opponents ahead of time. One famous cartoon from Alabama showed the KKK as a native Southern mule who had just left the scene of a lynching of local freedmen, scallywags, and carpetbaggers from Ohio. Let me give you a few more examples, more specific examples. From early 1866 until the end of June 1867, just 18 months, Klansmen in the Carolinas killed 197 people and assaulted nearly 500. Between 1866 and 1868, one county in Florida reported that the KKK killed more than 150 African Americans. And other Florida counties reported similar numbers, but they also included reports of the killings of dozens of white allies, in quotations, of freed blacks. The KKK's campaign of murder and intimidation was particularly bad in Louisiana. Over 2,000 people were killed in the run-up to the election, the presidential election of November 1868. They were killed both as punishment and as warnings. And we can measure the impact that the threat of KKK violence and violence from other groups had on potential voters, especially registered Republicans, if we compare registrations, for instance, before and after elections. The Republican Party in St. Landry Parish in Louisiana had a registered majority of 1,000, over 1,000, over the Democrats. They had more than 1,000 than the Democrats did and other parties in that county in 1868, early 1868. Now, after the murders in October and early November of that year, not a single Republican voted in that county on election day. Columbia County in Georgia also shows the effect that the Klan had in 1868 very, very clearly. The election for governor of Georgia was held in April of that year. 1,222 votes were cast for Rufus Bullock, the Republican candidate. By the time the presidential election rolled around in November, however, Klan violence and murder had so intimidated Republicans that only one person, a fearless white man apparently, voted Republican in that election. But it wasn't just electoral violence or violence against freed black men. The KKK was a secret society, and joining it meant that Klan members disguised themselves during their raids and killings. This meant they were protected by their disguises and usually were sworn to secrecy. So in addition to killing freedmen and attacking African-American women, destroying property and scaring Republicans away from the polls, some Klan members used the organization to settle personal scores, settle personal feuds, and bring a violent end to personal grudges, and in general, commit any crimes they wanted to, including rape. Now, I've been talking about the Klan this, the Klan that, as if it was building itself into a massive organization across the whole old Confederacy, you know, with a military-style command structure and coordinated activity. This was not the case, however. Apart from Klan groups throughout the South calling themselves the KKK, there was little organization or structure beyond the local level. Former Confederate generals such as George Gordon and Nathan Bedford Forrest tried to establish a cross-state organization, but they didn't succeed. And in fact, many historians have argued that it was precisely because the Klan stayed local and didn't attempt to form state organizations that they were able to conduct their raids and terrorize African Americans and others, like Republican politicians, who were trying to bring the South into the modern world. Local Klansmen were autonomous. They could act when and where they wanted. The larger an organization got, the more communication would be needed between the local groups, and the more likely that Republican state governments in the South could find ways to attack them and eliminate them. Well, how did Reconstructionists and others fight back against the Klan and like-minded terrorist groups? In some Southern areas where Union Army veterans had established themselves after the war, anti-Ku Klux groups were founded. Again, this was very local, and since it was local, these antis were often able to find out who was in the KKK in their area. And they responded to the KKK, their local KKK groups, by threatening them directly with reprisals that weren't that different in type and ferocity than the violence that Klansmen perpetuated on their victims. Nationally also, anti-Klan sentiment became very strong. Republican state governors informed Congress what was going on. Evidence was gathered, hearings were held, and a Ku Klux Klan Act, technically the Civil Rights Act of 1871, was passed. Although it was challenging to enforce, the act did have the effect of arresting Klansmen, and was aided by the fact that President Grant suspended habeas corpus and sent federal troops in to try to enforce it. Those who were arrested under the KKK Act were prosecuted in federal court. And along with local attempts at suppression, this federal action helped hasten the decline of the first Klan. By 1872, the KKK was gone, but not without leaving an awful legacy of death and terrorism in its wake. Well, let's take a break, and we'll return to tell you about the rise of the second KKK and how a motion picture helped start it all. Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers. I want to fast forward a little bit to the early 20th century and introduce you to a man named Thomas Dixon. Thomas Dixon was a Southern Baptist minister who wrote novels on the side in the early 20th century, and two of these novels, The Leopard Spots, 1902, and The Klansman, 1905, caught the attention of motion picture pioneer D.W. Griffith, who used them as for their plot lines in his blockbuster film Birth of a Nation, which came out in 1915. The first half of the film depicts a Northern family and a Southern family during the Civil War. And all wrapped up in the war are the relationship between the two families, or one of the sons is in love with one of the daughters from the other family, and on and on and on. So far, so typical. But the second half of the movie depicts Reconstruction in perhaps the most racist way possible. Freed African-American men are shown corrupting Southern politics. They're stuffing ballot boxes. They're acting like zoo animals in the South Carolina legislature. All the while, white men are denied the right to vote, and on and on and on. While watching one of his children playing ghosts and scaring each other, the lead white Southern character from one of the families comes up with the idea of using white robes and hoods as uniforms slash disguises for a new white militia that can save the South from the scourge of black rule. At two separate points in the plot, these new Klansmen, with their new robes, go on raids and terrorize black people. Now, again, the Klan robes and the hoods are prominent props in the film, as is a burning cross, again, used to scare African Americans. These two things, the white hoods and robes, and the burning cross, were entirely invented by the filmmakers and had not been used by the original Klan back in the late 1860s. The Birth of a Nation was a huge hit and was even shown to President Wilson and his family in the White House. And next week, we're going to have a quote-unquote episode on his reaction to the film. The iconography of the film, especially as depicted on its poster, which is a robed Klansman riding a steed and carrying an Anglo-Saxon flag, and the timing of its release were very important to the development and spread of the second KKK. The timing of its release, now this is not necessarily intentional timing for releasing it in the 19-teens, but it's important because there had been a growing anti-Catholic sentiment and anti-Jewish sentiment and hysteria over declining morals in the U.S. at that time and a surge in demand for the prohibition of alcohol. After he'd seen Birth of a Nation, and in response to his own response to some of these perceived dangers to American morality, Georgia businessman William Joseph Simmons convinced several of his friends and two surviving members of the first KKK, who were getting pretty old at that time, to found the second Ku Klux Klan in a highly ritualized cross-burning ceremony on the top of Stone Mountain, which is northeast of Atlanta, on Thanksgiving night, 1915. Remember, the first KKK is founded on Christmas Eve. This is found on the night of Thanksgiving. In a Klan pamphlet published 2 years later, Simmons laid out the purpose of the new Ku Klux Klan. It was, quote, to shield the sanctity of the home and the chastity of womanhood, to maintain white supremacy, to teach and faithfully inculcate a high spiritual philosophy through an exalted ritualism, and by practical devotedness to conserve, protect, and maintain the distinctive institutions, rights, privileges, principles, and ideals of a pure Americanism. The, quote, sanctity of the home and the chastity of womanhood, unquote, referred not only to their opposition to what they saw as a growing acceptance of divorce in America, but also to, again, what they saw as the creeping tide of general immorality in the country. This immorality included adultery, boozing, criminal gangs, and on and on and on. But this second Klan also defined Catholicism and Judaism and other non-American religions and philosophies as a threat to solid American Protestantism. Apart from this wider range of threats, the second KKK differed from the first in that it was eventually to grow into a nationwide organization, North and South, and urban as well as rural. Now, as the 1920s progressed, especially the early 1920s, William Joseph Simmons turned control of the Klan over to professional publicists and organizers, and eventually it spread to nearly every state. And as new threats, and I'm putting threats in quotation marks, buzzkillers, emerged on the American moral scene, the KKK added them to their hate list. Immigration, communism, and on and on and on. These things run in parallel. And again, unlike the original Klan, this second Klan was highly organized and highly structured, with local chapters reporting to state and regional offices and eventually to the national headquarters in Atlanta. The organization made money, by the way, through selling official regalia, the hoods, the robes, and official Klan literature, and membership fees. Although most of the membership fees stayed local, all this other stuff was done nationally. The biggest development in the history of the second KKK was its growth in the North and its rapid urbanization. By the end of the 1920s, this is a huge change, the overwhelming majority of Klansmen lived in urban areas, and Indiana, not Georgia, was the state with the most members and the most KKK chapters. other northern cities had large KKK populations. Detroit alone had 40,000 Klan members. 40,000. This was partly a result of many white Southerners moving north for industrial jobs in places like Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan, but also the result of a national trend in paranoia over these supposed threats to the nation's morality and the nation's majority Protestantism. The Klan started to hold large-scale marches in major cities and at big events, such as the 1924 Democratic Convention in New York. Buzzkillers can find many pictures online of open and public Klan marches across the country during this period. Another fascinating development in the 1920s and 1930s was that Klan chapters pushed for political and social reform in their respective states, which seems anti-Klan in a way. But listen, especially across the South, KKK members had a strong representation on city and county councils and in state legislatures. Now again, in addition to standing rock solid by prohibition and fighting any efforts to relax it, these KKK politicians also worked for better public schools, better road construction, road improvement, and similar infrastructure reforms. But the crucial thing to remember here, however, is what else was going on in those southern states in the first half of the 20th century. You see, parallel to the Klan's morality drives, southern legislatures were increasing public segregation throughout the region, and they were very successful. The improved public schools that the Klan pushed for were for whites only. The better roads that they pushed for obviously benefited poor and middle-class white farmers and merchants to a much greater degree than they benefited African-American laborers or Mexican-American laborers. KKK women's auxiliaries were also founded, again in the early 1920s, and they fought in the open to have the Klan's social agenda implemented by state and local governments. They were successful enough in Texas, for instance, that Catholics were banned by the state from working as teachers in public schools. The growth of the second KKK didn't go unnoticed, however. Many prominent Protestant ministers, despite the fact that the KKK ideology was very strictly Protestant, many prominent ministers spoke out against it. The Anti-Defamation League was founded during this period in response to the Klan's attack on Jewish Americans. Some anti-Klan groups in the North secretly infiltrated Klan membership, and they recorded lists of members and published that information in order to name and shame Klansmen. And a few sexual scandals within the Klan, as well as the Grand Dragon of Indiana's conviction for the rape and murder of a young white schoolteacher, caused a public outcry. And all this led to the Klan's gradual decline as a national organization from the late 1920s onwards. Still, remaining local chapters of the Klan committed atrocities, including murder, rape, and the burning of property, especially in KKK strongholds in the South. But in the 30s, in the early 40s, the press was more stringent than before in reporting these as terrorist attacks and reporting them in a highly negative way. And public support for the Klan wavered and eventually collapsed by the end of the 1930s. World War II certainly hastened the end of the second KKK when Americans realized that Klan ideologies were barely different from Nazism, and also when Americans were, you know, preoccupied with a two-front war. And so by 1944, the Klan national organization had filed for bankruptcy and was more or less defunct. The second KKK's impressive organizational skills from the 1920s apparently could not sustain them against growing public opposition, and they went broke. Sadly, the Klan's type of deep hatred never entirely disappeared from the United States, and especially in the South. After the war, local Klans organized again in most Southern states, but particularly in Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. They adopted the second KKK's costumes and rituals, the white robes, the burning crosses, but not its national organization, at least not right away. This third Ku Klux Klan became one of the most deadly versions in Klan's history. As civil rights for African Americans became a bigger issue in American consciousness throughout the 1950s, local racists joined together to terrorize civil rights campaigners, white as well as black. Birmingham, Alabama became known as Bombingham during that decade because local Klansmen planted bombs in the homes of African Americans. They tried to bomb meetings of civil rights organizations, and they terrorized them with other types of murders. You see, Birmingham was the home of the steel industry in the South, and many Klansmen worked in factories or similar places where they had easy access to explosives and to the types of metals that make excellent and deadly shrapnel. Making bombs was sort of almost, it could have been almost daily thing for some of them. And rather than try to organize together across the South or make a national movement, the local clans concentrated on influencing and forming alliances with the technically legitimate city, county, and state governments in those areas. Birmingham's police department was riddled with Klansmen and Klan sympathizers. And Birmingham's police chief, Bull Connor, gave local Klansmen time to attack the Freedom Riders, civil rights Freedom Riders, in 1961, before his police force stepped in to stop the violence. It was vicious. Between 1951 and 1968, not a month went by without a violent Klan attack against black people in Alabama, in Mississippi, in Georgia. And dozens of these made national, international news, including the 1964 murders of civil rights workers Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner in Mississippi. Klan violence was so strong, and local police and government reactions so weak, that the federal government had to step in to try to stop it. But again, it's just complicated. This wasn't immediate. In fact, Washington, D.C. was slow to stop the killing. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was more interested in discrediting civil rights organizations by trying to expose communists within their ranks than in stopping the bombings and shootings of African Americans. In fact, it wasn't until 1965, after a great deal of pressure from Congress, a great deal of pressure from President Johnson, that the FBI started overt anti-Klan investigations and activities. Federal government investigations and the sheer weight of evidence of Klan brutality exposed by the press gradually started to eat away at public support for the Klan in the South. Still, throughout the 1970s, Klan chapters rallied and demonstrated against civil rights. Many prominent colleges and universities had KKK chapters on their campuses. And murders and terrorist activities continued throughout the 1980s and 1990s. So in the final decades of the 20th century, different Klan chapters made use of new technology, such as the internet, to spread their messages of hate and to gain new members. Using online bulletin boards such as Stormfront, they joined with white nationalists, with neo-Nazis, and other hate groups in a broad movement of discrimination and violence and terrorism that we see today. Perhaps modern communication has replaced official Klan organization in the 1920s and replaced the cooperation of local and state governments of the 50s and 60s. So maybe they do have a sort of larger structure to fall back on. Now, legitimate police forces have similar tools to try and combat this high-tech organization of hatred. But will it be enough? It'll probably also require the help of all decent people. We need to put political pressure on governments, and we need to enlighten people about how badly these things can get and how quickly they can get worse if we want this historical cycle of KKK violence and hate to stop. Talk to you next week.